Hello, I'm Brian Lee Crowley, author of Fearful Symmetry, The Fall and Rise of Canada's Founding Values, and I'd like to read you an extract from the book. This passage describes one of the central themes in the book, namely how the rise of the baby boom generation transformed Canada, and, more importantly, how the ebbing of that tide will change the country just as profoundly again in the coming decades. Over the last 50 years, the number of workers in Canada grew more, proportionally speaking, than in any other major industrialized country. From 1956 to 2006, our workforce grew by 200%, and the growth in the number of young people of working age in Quebec led the pack in the early days. Even America, our nearest rival, was well behind us, growing by a relatively restrained 120% or so. By contrast, in the next 50 years, it is our workforce that will grow by a paltry 11%, better than many of our European counterparts who will see shrinkage in absolute terms, but well behind America, where the number of workers will grow by nearly a third. Starting in 2011, population will grow faster in Canada than the labor force, and that trend will continue for 40 years. Already today, after nearly 50 years of the labor force growing by an average of 1% a year, every year, and often by much more, we are in a period where it is growing at half that rate. By 2016, a few short years away, the number of net new workers entering the workforce will be zero, and will be slightly negative for a decade after that. We are teetering on the edge of a demographic cliff, and we have one foot out in the air. In just a few short years, then, it could be the values of social democratic welfareism that will seem a quaint echo of a receding past. Politically, any party that can capture the high ground of Canada's traditional values for the next generation will likely become the dominant party because it will speak directly to the anxieties of Canadians. These citizens will be increasingly aware that their standard of living is being squeezed because many jobs will go undone, new investments will be foregone, and profits will go unmade because not enough people are available to work. This does not mean necessarily that this shift towards traditional Canadian values will result in conservative governments. In fact, the traditional values that guided Canada in its first century were, for many years, the values of the Liberal Party of Canada. It is only in the years after 1960 that the party truly embraced a state-centered vision on a large scale for Canadians. And given their historical ability to remain free of ideological commitments and embrace whatever cause will win them electoral success, Liberals will be able to read the demographic entrails as well as anyone. Happily, these new circumstances will also allow the party, or parties, that harness them to escape the charge of being flint-hearted. Voters will relax their instinctive assumption that there are no jobs and replace it with the new reality that there are not enough workers and jobs are going begging. Paying people not to work or paying them to do pseudo-work will then be transmuted from a social necessity decent people understand and support to a costly extravagance that causes political resentment and friction. Because work will be widely available and will be seen to be widely available, further welfare reform and elimination of pseudo-work will not be seen as an attack on the poor or blaming the victim, but as a way to confer on them the individual and social benefits of working. Welfare in its various guises will not be eliminated, but will shift from an alternative to working to an incentive to work. This can already be seen in the provincial welfare reforms that began in the 1990s. The introduction in the 2007 federal budget of the working income tax benefit is a more recent example. It will eventually guarantee that people at the bottom end of the income scale will be made reliably better off by working than by staying on benefits. Similarly, the new natural governing party will be the party of social inclusion, because there are important parts of the population who have been previously unable to participate fully in the workforce. Aboriginals, some racial minorities, and some women are still not able to work as much as they may want to or up to their level of skill and ability. Decades of welfare for Aboriginals and public sector pseudo-work for all these groups has done too little to change their status. A labor shortage, combined with a government's determination to open the benefits of work to all who are capable of it, will make the new traditionalists the voice of real inclusion. Immigrants, too, will be high on the traditionalists' priorities, as it will be imperative to make it easier to enter Canada, but the immigrants who come will need more support to integrate successfully into the Canadian economy than has been the case in the past. A country with too few workers is also a country compelled to be open to trade, for so-called offshoring is merely Canadians using the labor force in other countries to produce the products, services, and profits to fund their retirements that they need. Provinces begging for workers will gladly tear down the barriers to trade within Canada that have now become a constraint on their growth, rather than a welcome protection for beleaguered workers threatened by a sea of unemployed. The so-called TILMA, the Trade, Investment, and Labour Mobility Agreement between British Columbia and Alberta, that moves aggressively to tear down barriers to trade between two of our most economically dynamic provinces, is only a precursor of a more liberal trade regime within the country as a whole. Free trade will be a touchstone of the new traditionalism. Identifying and removing the obstacles to Canadians having as many children as they would like will become a social and economic imperative, and will place the resurgent traditional values at the heart of a renewal of family life. And we will reevaluate relations between the sexes in our quest to encourage Canadians to have more babies, for our poor level of fertility is, before all else, a reflection of a profound malaise in relations between men and women. Basically, tax and other incentives to have children, while far from irrelevant, have at best a rather marginal effect on fertility. We need to learn to love and trust each other better, and to be more committed to each other, and to put the needs of our most vulnerable, our children, ahead of the desires of adults. This will require us to revisit our experience with unilateral, no-fault divorce, especially where children are involved. We will better align the incentives for parents who want to have more children and be close to them, but cannot afford to neglect their careers when that is the one asset they take away intact from marriage breakdown. The fiscal demands of aging, plus the need to reduce the size of the state in order to improve our economic performance, will lead to a rolling back of the state's ambition to supplant much of the family's role, both because the state is a poor parent and because it is too expensive in an era of population aging and labor shortages. Also falling out from this renewed preoccupation with the family will be a re-examination of the old one-size-fits-all approach to labor legislation, workplace rules, and a host of other programs that will increasingly be shaped by labor shortages rather than the labor bubble of the post-war years. Working will be a more protean idea, and workers will have more choices and more power in the workplace than perhaps they have ever known. Parenthetically, that will make antediluvian trade unions even more irrelevant than they are today. Finally, all these new circumstances put within reach an historic New Deal that might cement Quebec's attachment to Confederation for a generation. A withdrawal of Ottawa from much of its role as redistributor of wealth between parts of the country, ceasing to be an enabler of taking behavior and giving up a major source of revenue to the provinces, to give them both the power and also the ultimate responsibility for their social policy choices. In return, Ottawa can reinvigorate its presence and authority in the lives of Canadians by rejuvenating its proper role as protector of Canadians' economic freedom and prosperity, as well as of their national freedom and security from external threat. That this is essentially a return to 1867, and therefore our founding values, makes this package even more attractive. Put all this together. The demographic reversal, massive increase of movement of Canadians, labor shortages, the destinations of immigrants, the accelerating decline of regions caught in the past, the new political and economic power of growing and economically dynamic provinces, such as Alberta, British Columbia, Ontario, and increasingly Saskatchewan. The increasing irrelevance of Quebec's preoccupations to the rest of the country. The distribution of births across the country. And a new congruence between traditional social values and the needs of the Canadian economy. That low rumble you hear is the traditionalist juggernaut gathering force across the land. When it reaches full strength, it will leave nothing as it was.